The book of Esther is one of those, it's not that long of a book, really, and it's just got a wonderful story in it. In fact, I think, I was going to say it would be fit for a movie, but I think they did make a movie about Queen Esther, and whether it's biblically accurate or not, I can't say. One of the unusual things about the book of Esther, the name of God is not mentioned in it. And yet, in no other book of the Bible can the hand of God be seen more clearly. It's a beautiful example of God's providence. Providence, the word, is actually comes to us in English from Latin, and the word is literally it's a compound word, pro meaning before, and video, to see before. The English word providence is found in the English Bible, in the King James once, and in the ASV. Other translations use the word foresight. But in Acts 24 and 2, the King James says, "And when he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him, Paul, saying, seeing that by thee, Ananias, we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence." By your foresight, a seeming prearrangement of some sort. Now, the Greek word, which is translated providence, is found in Romans 13:14, where it's translated as provision. Paul says, "But put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof." So, and we see in the English word providential, we see the stem provide. So it combines all these elements of providing on the basis of being able to see beforehand. We do that every day. So-and-so's going to need this. I better take it to him. You saw the need before it arose. There were certain things. If Dad was doing a task, he says, someone will rotate the tires today. I knew that was my clue to go out in the garage and get the jack out and jack stands and get them ready. So he didn't have to tell me. That was my clue. And just in case you've forgotten, the providential working of God differs from the supernatural working of God. And when we say supernatural, simply mean miraculous, because it's above the natural. Biblical miracles were events that could not happen naturally. Okay? Miracles are those events which could not happen naturally. That's why it's a misnomer when we hear people talking about the miracle of childbirth. I know some babies are born what we call naturally. Others are born through a cesarean section. Other than that, that's about it. But there was nothing miraculous about it, because that is the way God designed the human race to perpetuate, through birth. And really, if you want to get down to brass tacks and technicalities, There was nothing miraculous about the birth of Christ, but the conception of Christ. Miracles serve the purpose of demonstrating conclusively that the person who was the agent of God doing the miracle had the approval of God in the things that he said and taught. Maybe when you think of the word providence, I want you to think of the word perhaps. When you think of the word providence in the Bible, I want you to think of the word perhaps. Perhaps I should take something to somebody because they're going to need it. Perhaps I should go get the jack in the jack stands. I told you this story. I'll just briefly remind you of it. One day I said, perhaps I should call Brother Charles Abbey to see how he's doing since he fell and broke his leg. And so I called Brother Abbey, and he gave me Norm's phone number, which he had gotten from Flavel Miller because Cambridge was looking for a preacher. I didn't call Brother Abbey looking for a job. I called him to check on him, see how he was doing. And here we are, 8 years, 8.5 years later. Perhaps. If we heed the message of James, James kind of implies this idea of perhaps. If we look at James chapter 4 and verse 13 and following, where James writes, go to, ye that say today or tomorrow, we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. Whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. For ye ought to say, perhaps you should say it this way, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. Perhaps we can go into this city and buy and sell and get gain or do this or that. Perhaps we won't be able to. It's the idea of providence. And if we heed the message of James, we will not arrogantly presume on planning the future without taking God into consideration. There's nothing wrong with making plans. Please don't mistake me. I opened the lesson tonight saying, if any of you are planning on going deer hunting tomorrow, that's your plan. And if you say, yeah, we're going to go deer hunting tomorrow, I don't think that's being arrogant. But if you have made plans and you haven't included God in the equation, then you're being presumptuous. I'm not, and I know a lot of people, and I've developed the habit, I guess, but I mean it. When, many times I'll say, God willing this or God willing that. And I do it as a reminder for myself as much as anything. Esther, the book of Esther, has special application to us because if we read Esther and we pay attention to what's going on, we see God at work behind the scenes. It is clear from the book of Esther that God did work in their lives, her and Mordecai. And it's clear to me that God can still work in our lives, even though the miraculous ended 2,000 years ago, or nearly 2,000 years ago. Mordecai challenges Esther in our reading this evening that Brother Raymond read for us in verse 14. Mordecai challenges Esther to consider the providence of God when he says to her, "And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Stated another way, perhaps God arranged things in such a way for you to be on the throne at this time. Well, what was so special about this time? So I would like to go back to the first, or the beginning of the book of Esther. And I would like for us to look at, and I'm going to just try to overview the salient points that show what Mordecai was talking about when he said such a time as this. And if you're a Bible student, you know the story already. But let's just refresh ourselves. In verses 1 and 2, we see a time of far-reaching decisions. We see in chapter 1, I said verses 1 and 2, I meant chapters 1 and 2, a time of far-reaching decisions. In chapter 1, we see the decision of the king to get rid of his queen at the time. Chapter 1, verse 1 says, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus," this is Ahasuerus which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces, "that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan," some of your translations might say Susa, "the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and servants." So we're introduced to Ahasuerus. He's also called Xerxes in other parts of the Bible. And so the king hosts a couple parties in verses 3 through 12. So in the third year of his reign, in verse 3, he made a feast for all the princes and his servants, the powers of Persia and Media. So we're in the Medo-Persian Empire right now. This feast was probably to garner support for an attack that he was going to launch against the Greeks the next year. It's not recorded in the Bible, but we know from secular history that he launched an attack against the Greeks in about the fourth year of his reign or so. So he's launched this party to gain support from his fellows. And so this party goes on for a really long time, like 120 days. And when that party was over, as if they hadn't partied enough, in verse 5, we have the after party. If you've ever watched, if you've ever made yourself sit through the Academy Awards, they always talk about the party that happens before, and then they have the award show, which is entirely too long, and then they have the after party, where they all stand around and congratulate one another. So now at the after party, in verses 6 through 12, this is a smaller gathering. And the king shows some of these nobles how wealthy he is, and how the king's palace is decorated and adorned. And verse 7, he says they gave them wine and vessels of gold, and the vessels being diverse from one another. Each one was unique. It was a keepsake they could take home. It was one of a kind. And the Bible says in verse 7, "and royal wine in abundance." Basically, this was an after party with an open bar. And in verse 10, in his drunken stupor, on the seventh day of this small after party, "when the king's heart was merry with wine," verse 10, "he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagatha, Zether, and Caracas, the seven chamberlains or seven eunuchs that served in the presence of the king, to bring Vashti, his queen, before the king with the royal crown to show the people and his princes her beauty, for she was fair to look upon." Many have suggested that Ahasuerus wanted Vashti to come out with the royal crown on her head and nothing else. He wanted her to parade herself in front of these drunken goons. And she refused. She says, I'm not going to do it. A lot of preachers have held Vashti up as a role model for women, especially where it comes was concerned with modesty and those kinds of things. But we have to ask ourselves, why do you think she really didn't do it? Why do you think she refused to dance or to parade herself in a lewd fashion in front of these drunken partygoers? Was it beneath her dignity? Probably not. Was she afraid of the drunks? That makes sense. Was this a power struggle between her and her husband, the king? Could be. It probably was not modesty, knowing the culture. But the king is furious. Verse 12. And then in verse 13, he gathers his wise men. He assembles a panel of experts. And he says, what shall we do unto the queen? Because according to the law, she hath not performed the commandment of the king. And so in verse 16, Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes and to all the people that are in the provinces of the king of Ahasuerus. In other words, she hasn't only disgraced you, king, she has made a spectacle of herself to the whole kingdom, because word's going to get about that Vashti didn't frolic in front of the crowd. And then he says in verse 17, for this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all the women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes. In other words, she is setting a precedent that we don't want to have to deal with. Because, why, if the queen doesn't have to obey the king, then I'm just a lowly prince, my wife will say, well, I don't have to obey you because the queen didn't obey the king, and you see the trickle-down effect. And so these guys are saying, King, you've got to Barney Fife this thing. You got to nip it in the bud. So the king makes a decree in verses 19 to 22 that was suggested to him. Do you remember what the law of the Medes and the Persians means? It means if they made a law according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, this law could never be rescinded. It was chiseled in stone. And of all the things they chose to observe, they stuck with their law of the Medes and the Persians. So he says in verse 19, what are we going to do with the queen? Here's the answer. If it please the king, let there be a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it not be altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate unto another that is better than she. In other words, let the king not divorce Vashti, but replace her with one that's better. And likely what he means by one that's better is one that'll do what he wants her to do when he wants her to do it. So the king makes a decree, and Vashti is demoted and put back in the harem, And another queen was going to be chosen, and so these official letters were sent forth. That's where chapter 1 ends. Now, between chapter 1 and chapter 2, there's a time lapse of about 4 years. And it is during this time that King Ahasuerus attacks the Greeks in Salamis and is defeated. So that's why chapter 2 opens, after these things, probably refers to the defeat he suffered and comes back home to lick his wounds. When the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti. He still loved her. He probably would have taken her back, except for the law of the Medes and the Persians, but he missed her. And so one of the king's servants in verse 2 says, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. They're going to have tryouts to see who would muster up to be queen. So then we are introduced to a couple Jews named Mordecai and Esther. Verses 5 through 8. And Esther is selected. But here's the thing. It's not known that she's a Jew. It's not known by the king that she is a Jew. It says in verse 8 that Esther was brought also into the king's house to the custody of the Haggai, the keeper of the woman. And verse 10, Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred. She had not shown who she was as a Jew and who her kindred were. So Esther was, they took turns, I guess you would say. She was chosen to be among the women who would be chosen by the king. They'd narrowed it down some. And so in verse 12, now when every maid's turn was come to go in to King Ahasuerus for this tryout, after that she had been 12 months according to the manner of woman, for so were the days of their purification accomplished, to wit, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with sweet odors and with other things for the purifying of the women. Then thus came every maiden unto the king. Whatsoever she desired was given her to go with her out of the house of the woman unto the king's house. In the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned into the second house of the woman. So they kept them in one house, on deck, we might say, and then one would go spend the night with the king, and then when that rendezvous was over, then she would go to this other house. They kept the ones who had tried out separate from the ones who had not yet tried out. And the king told them, once they tried out and went to the other house, in verse 14, basically she said she came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, and that she were called by name. In other words, when they went to the house after their tryout, they said, don't call us, we'll call you. Now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go into the king, she required nothing. So all these women, after with their tryout with the king, they were allowed to ask something of the king as a token or as maybe remuneration of some kind. Esther didn't do that after her encounter with the king. She required nothing but what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the woman, appointed. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. So Esther was taken unto the king into his royal house in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So here's the situation now. Vashti, a Jew, is a queen in the Persian Empire. And she's still, verse 20, and Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people. She's still a closet Jew in the Persian kingdom. Now, Mordecai, her relative, uncovers a plot against King Ahasuerus. There were some people that was going to kill the king. And the thing was known to Mordecai in verse 22, and he told it to Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king. In other words, she told him, she made him safe, she made him secure by telling him what was going to happen. And the men who were going to form this inquisition, verse 23, when it was found out and found out who they were, the Bible says they were, well, the King James says they were hanged on a tree, which literally means they were impaled on a stake. And after these things, as chapter 3 opens, and chapter 3 we call a time of long-standing animosity. And it's the animosity of this scoundrel named Haman that we're going to be introduced to, which Ahasuerus promoted for some reason in verse 1 of chapter 3. Now, he's a descendant from King Agag, and he was promoted, high official under King Ahasuerus. And he was such a high official that when the common people met him in the way, they should have genuflected or did obeisance. They should have practically worshipped him. But Mordecai, being a Jew, wouldn't do that because he worshipped the only the one true God. And the fact that he would not, that Mordecai would not bow or pay homage to Haman incensed Haman to the point that he wanted to kill not only Mordecai, but all the Jews. And so Haman, being the crafty, slick huckster that he was, he devised a plan. He has to get the king to agree to want to kill the Jews. Haman's the one that wants them dead, but he has to convince King Ahasuerus that Ahasuerus wants them dead too. And verse 6 of chapter 3, he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews. So somebody ratted out Mordecai as a Jew. Esther's still safe, but Haman knows Mordecai is a Jew. And he sought to destroy all the Jews that were in the kingdom throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. And in the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they, Haman's astrologers, cast pur in the King James. The New King James and other translations probably say they cast lots. And that was some kind of hocus pocus way of picking their lottery numbers, basically. And Haman says to King Ahasuerus in verse 8, there's a certain people scattered abroad in your kingdom that do not keep your laws. And it is not in the king's best interest to allow these people to live. So basically what Haman is trying to do here is announce open season on the Jews. Sound familiar? And so the king, in verse 10, takes off his signet ring, and he gives it to Haman, and he says, do what you think's best. So Haman initiates a Persian Holocaust, basically. Verse 4, we see a time of life-threatening choices. Or chapter 4, rather. As chapter 3 closed, we see that these messengers went out saying, these messengers went out through the land decreeing what was going to happen. The Jews are going to be killed. And so as chapter 4 begins, Mordecai perceived all that was done. He rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry. So there was a time of national mourning because he knows his people are, they've been selected to be killed. And he puts on sackcloth and ashes. And not only is he feared for his life and feared for his people, I think he probably feels partly responsible. If he'd have just bowed to Haman a little bit, if he would have just compromised a little bit, right? Then his life would have been easier. But here's the thing, when you compromise your faith in God, you compromise your faith in God. And Mordecai wouldn't do it. And so he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes. And this is how the living identify with the dead. The torn clothing, the sackcloth, the ashes, was to symbolize a corpse. So he put on the attire of a corpse and made himself look like a corpse. So Mordecai challenges Esther. Verse 8, it says verse 7, Mordecai told him of all that had happened to him. He's talking to Hatach. And the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the Jews to destroy them. And he gave them a copy of the writing of the decree that was given at Shushan to destroy the Jews, to show it to Esther. He says, I've got to get word to the queen. The king doesn't realize what he's done. Maybe if I can go to the queen, maybe she can intervene and do something. And Esther spake unto Hatach, and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. And here's what she said. Verse 11. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether a man or woman, shall come to the king into the inner court who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter that he may live. But I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. And so they told Mordecai, Esther saying, listen, you remember, Mordecai, that unless the king summons somebody into the inner court, if the king doesn't delight in what they have to say and he withholds the scepter, then I'll be put to death. Even the queen had to live by that law. So now look at Esther's predicament. They're going to find out she's a Jew. And she will be killed. But if she goes to the king, and if perhaps he holds out his scepter, she will live. And that's what Mordecai tells her. Verse 13, then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not to thyself that thou shalt escape in the Jews' house more than all the other Jews. For if thou beholdest Or if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. Mordecai is a man of faith. Did you realize what he said there? He said, don't think, in verse 13, don't think that you're going to escape this. You're going to die if you don't go. And he says, if you don't say anything, in verse 14, then the enlargement or the relief and the deliverance for the Jews is going to arise from another source. Mordecai is confident that the Jews are going to be rescued somehow. He doesn't know how. But he sees a way it can happen. And that is if Esther goes to the king and pleads. That's Mordecai's plan A. But he's convinced that there's a plan B, C, and on perhaps. But he's trying to get the queen to do the right thing. If you thou together holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knows whether you are come to the kingdom for such a time as this? He's saying perhaps this is why God enabled you, a Jewess, to be the queen in the Persian Empire. Maybe this is why you've been put here in this place. Perhaps. Perhaps. Esther finally gets it. And in verse 16, Esther says, go, gather all the Jews that are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will likewise fast. And so will I go unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. I don't think the Bible intends to tell us that we are all put here for one great historic act. But I think what the Bible's telling us is that God can use some of the most unlikely circumstances and people to accomplish His will. And you and I, brethren and friends, are links in that divine chain. Perhaps. Perhaps. In chapter 5 through chapter 9, we see a time of life-preserving action. As it turns out, the king does receive Esther, holds out the golden scepter, and she does not die. And she gives a couple banquets to the king. Haman, he's ready to hang Mordecai. The Bible tells us that he builds a gallows 75 feet high. Well, one night the king has trouble sleeping, and he gets the Chronicles to read. And he reads this thing where Mordecai had spared his life. And the king says, you know, we didn't reward Mordecai for sparing my life. And so at the second of these two banquets, Mordecai's plot is revealed. And Haman's plot is revealed. And Haman, get this, he ends up being impaled on them gallows that he built for Mordecai. Isn't that something, how things turn around? You talk about irony. Now, the original decree for the killing of the Jews could not be repealed because it was by the law of the Medes and the Persians. But a counter decree is written wherein the Jews were allowed to defend themselves and retaliate. Well, what happens to most bullies when they walk up to a little guy? And they've gotten by with this before, because bullies always pick on the smaller guys. And the bullies squash them. Until he runs into one of these little guys that jumps up in the air to hit him in the nose. But every time he jumps, he hits him three times. The bully's going to run. And that's what happened here. Hey, you mean the Jews are allowed to fight back? Well, we're not touching that with a 10-foot pole. But on the day appointed for the massacre, the Jews are assisted by the king's forces, and they whoop the bullies. And then in chapter 9, 17 to chapter 10, verse 3, is a time of long-lasting celebration. You ever heard of the Feast of Purim? P-U-R-I-M. This is a Jewish feast that they initiated after this incident because of when Haman's men cast lots. This was the time of their deliverance, and Mordecai is exalted. And so here's the thing I want us to take away from this. Never underestimate the importance of one person doing the will of God. Never underestimate the importance of one person doing the will of God. Never underestimate the danger of holding a grudge like Haman. Never underestimate the danger of holding a grudge. Brethren, I'm here to tell you tonight, if you're holding a grudge against somebody, you better let it go. Because I'm here to tell you, nobody is strong enough to carry a grudge into heaven. You can't do it. I promise you. Let it go. Perhaps the greatest lesson is that if we make ourselves available to God, He will use us. Make yourself available to God. Let me ask this question. You know, Mordecai said to Esther, "Who knows whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Why has God put me in this place at this time? Why am I here for such a time as this?" Maybe it's to be faithful. Maybe it's to raise godly children. Maybe it's to be a godly husband or wife to a godly wife or husband. Maybe it's to preach the gospel. Maybe it's to teach the gospel to people, not from a pulpit, but from the living room. We can all do it. We've all got something to do. Each one of us can reach one, if we will. This evening, if you're not a child of God, perhaps you've been wrestling with thoughts like this, and perhaps providentially tonight you needed to hear this lesson from the inspired word of God to encourage you. If you've never obeyed the gospel, why not take this time to do it? And if you have obeyed the gospel, perhaps you need your strength renewed. Perhaps you need to repent. We're here to help you. Perhaps God has allowed you to be at this place at this time for just such a thing. If you're subject to the Lord's invitation, please come forward now while we stand and sing.